Hello, and this is the Personal Wealth Coach. There are lots of fun stuff going on the studio now, so no bumper music. Let me check and make sure mic 2 is up because I have to get some other things going while we're getting ready. So mic 2 is up. You should be able to talk.
So I can say with a lag, once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, without bumper music, but with the Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and Jake McClure. And we're a little bit, he just walked through going that way.
Okay.
We're a little bit out of the power curve here, to say the least, this morning, since the programming was changed in here while we were out. And we have to kind of wing it as we go. But this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we are to disclose both the radio program, which you can tell if you're listening, and the name of a SEC registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas. That doesn't mean the SEC approves of us or disapproves of us. It just means that's our regulator and that's who we work with. And we are going, even though we're a registered investment advisory firm, and Jake and I, this is Jeff speaking, are the principals in that registered investment advisory firm. We give out investment advice. This program is not investment advice. It is educational instead, and that's all it's intended to be. Another thing we need to announce is that we advertise on KTEM. We don't pay for the radio program, but we do advertise on KTEM. And what else do I need to announce? Let's see. Not investment advice. That's probably pretty much it. Telephone number in here if you'd like to give us a call.
Let me throw in something else on the radio program thing. We don't advertise
on
here.
I already said that.
Yeah, I'm going to throw this in. Because we're saying it kind of like it's a negative. We don't get paid to do the radio program. That's something that most people don't realize. They think we either pay for it or we get paid. Neither of those is true. We have our normal advertisement throughout the week on the air here. So at the end of each hour, we give our phone numbers to call. And that's as much of an advertisement from the program that we get. We consider this to be educational and a public service. So that's what I wanted to throw in there.
Okay. Are we going to play? Do we have music we're going to play, or are we just going to?
We do have music. It was set up under a different system. So we'll play. You would you like to play the music?
I don't know.
Make you feel good?
I don't know. It's up to you.
We're already on the air. I think people want to hear us now that we're here.
Well, let's talk about the market then. This was an interesting week. Of course, they're generally interesting from our perspective. May not be from yours. But the through Thursday, the S&P 500 and the rest of the market rose kind of nicely. It looked like it was on its way to another 1% or 2% gain for the week. Matter of fact, it was going to be up around 2%, it looked like. And then Friday morning, the bottom sort of fell out. The S&P 500 dropped 2% on Friday morning. And what caused that? Well, a double whammy. Actually, a single whammy that hit a second whammy, and then the second whammy hit the stock market. The problem was that the Purchasing Managers Index, actually the IHS Purchasing Managers Index for the Eurozone, was released in the wee hours of the morning on Friday morning. And it showed that the Purchasing Managers Index, which had been at 49.7, which is just below 50, and 50 is the point where it's either rising or falling, took a bit of a nosedive and dropped down to about 46. Which indicates that the purchasing managers, the people who buy stuff for manufacturers so that they can make more stuff in Europe, said that we are shrinking. The manufacturing sector of the economy is about to shrink in Europe. It's about to shrink fairly quickly compared with what it's been doing in the past. That caused the bond market in the United States, and for that matter around the rest of the world, but notably the Treasury bond market in the United States, to react to it. And it reacted because last week we reported that the output for U.S. manufacturing in the United States dropped 0.2% in February. And it's been slowing down, and then it just dropped. And that's not a good sign. Manufacturing is not a huge part of our economy. Later on in the day, we got another report that said that a very delayed report, that in the fourth quarter of last year, just because the government shut down, we're just now getting the report, the services sector of our economy only grew 1.2%. Now, that you think that's a really, okay, so it grew 1.2%. The reality is earlier in the year, it was growing at 5%. And when it drops to 1.2% and is sliding downhill, and there's more evidence that it's dropping in the first quarter, well, the bond curve inverted.
Yep. The yield curve, as we often call it, basically, as soon as economists start talking about the yield curve, people's eyes glaze over and they go, "What in the world are we talking about? This is
it's an exciting subject."
Oh, for us, it's extremely exciting. For most people, it's boring. We're gonna try to make it less boring.
Let's make it exciting.
Simple thought is that if you're getting a mortgage, and if you look at the interest rates on your mortgage at 30 years, they're generally higher than the rate on your interest at a 15-year mortgage. So your payment's going to go up because you're paying it off in 15 years, but your interest rate is lower. And that's a normal, healthy loaning environment. People will want to loan. If you're making a loan, you get to charge a higher interest rate because your money's at risk for a longer period of time. So can you explain what's going on with the yield curve now, keeping that in mind?
The Treasury notes, bonds, bills, and notes are the kind of benchmark for everything else that goes on out there.
That's us and other people loaning money to the U.S. government.
Yeah, because the U.S. government is considered to be a risk-free entity when it comes to loaning money to them. They will pay you back. Now, there may be inflation in the future, so they may pay you back with less valuable dollars. But the key in understanding that the United States Treasury is the benchmark for everything else is to understand that it's considered to be a risk-free loan if you hold it to maturity. So the pure interest rate issue is all that's in there. And short-term interest rates, 1 month, U.S. Treasury bills for 1 month are yielding right now 2.49%. Was it? 2.4, yeah, 2.49%. They did with the close on Friday. But the 10-year Treasury note, which means you will loan money to the Treasury and they'll pay you back 10 years from now, is only yielding 2.44. It even gets more interesting if you look at 5 years, three and five-year note interest rates, and you note at that point that they're like in the 2.3 range, which means longer maturity Treasury securities are yielding less than short-term Treasury securities. Now, what that says, in essence, it's a voting machine where all the people who buy and sell bonds have concluded that somewhere between 2 and 5 years in the future, the United States economy will be running a lot slower than it is today.
Yeah.
Now, when the bond market, all the many firms and people who have skin in the game by buying treasuries internationally and domestically, most of it's domestic, when they conclude that things are going to slow down, they really have a pretty good handle on it because they're in the loaning business and they see where people are making loans and where they're not making loans. And as a result, over the last several decades, last 40 or 50 years or so at least, and maybe longer, but we don't have a lot of good data beyond that. When we have an inverted yield curve that stays inverted for an extended period of time, I know that's a rough thing, but if it stays a month or two in an inverted situation, a recession so far has been 100%. It's kind of like when your barometer drops, you're near the ocean, and your barometer drops a whole bunch and stays down.
That's generally a storm on the way.
You're probably going to get a hurricane or at least a big gale or something, and
right.
you might want to batten down the hatches or whatever it is that you need to do. And that's the situation that we find ourselves in. And considering that in November, this Treasury note that's now yielding 2.44% was yielding 3.29%.
Yeah.
That is a huge drop in interest rates in a very short period of time. It has nothing to do with the Federal Reserve. Has nothing to do with the Federal Reserve's decision to raise or lower short-term interest rates.
Zero to do with that.
It has to do with the fact that the people who buy and sell bonds in the United States have concluded that a recession is very likely to occur roughly in 2020 or 20. Mainly, the consensus is 2020. Some people think 2021.
All right. And we have a caller on 773-1400. Who has braved the airwaves to talk to two bald men.
Yes, with no bumper music.
Two bearded bald men with no bumper music. So
bumperless bearded bald men.
Caller on 773-1400, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, first you scared me because I wasn't sure if you were coming on this week with no bumper music. But anyway, I was wondering is what you were just discussing about the bond interest rates and so forth. I saw a story this week, probably on USA Today, but it was talking about, it made it seem like it was a very dire thing. So mortgage rates plummeted from a rate of 4.0 to 4.34. And so 0.06% was just this dire thing. And I didn't quite understand why, 0.06% would be such a horrific thing. I just wondered if you could explain that for me. And
that's a very good question, and I've actually asked the same question.
Right. I'll give you the short answer: 0.06%. By the way, just for useless trivia, and your next barbecue party, a basis point is 0.01%.
Yeah,
so if you just start, or a bip. So if you just say it's dropped 6 bips, I don't know why that's a tragedy. People immediately think you know a lot about what you're talking about because you have one extra piece of vocabulary. But that by itself is not the catastrophe. The lowering of the long-term mortgage rates is not the catastrophe. The cause for the lowering of the long-term mortgage rates is the catastrophe. And it isn't the one-day shift of 6 bips, to use the term there. It is the long last 6 month decline. The cause of that is fewer mortgages. So when less people are buying houses, that's not good for the economy. There's a lot of money that gets put into the economy when a house gets bought.
Yet the issue is not so much that it was 6 basis points, although that when you 6 basis points amounts to something significant when you're looking at really low interest rates to begin with. But still, the issue is the direction it's going. It's like the interest rates have been rising for the past several years, most of the past decade, but they've been rising for the past several years, indicating that there's an increased demand for loans. Increased demand for loans means the economy is accelerating. When it starts going the other way, it's kind of like if you're driving along and you got your accelerator in the same position, and then at the beginning of the year in this drive along, you're driving the economy, you press down hard on the accelerator, which is what happened at the beginning of 2018. With the tax cuts and the increase in spending, we pressed down really hard on the accelerator. We accelerated for a little bit. And now, despite the fact that the accelerator is still full on the floor, the car is slowing down. That would probably indicate to you that there's something wrong with your engine.
The engine's seeing some problems, and that's the dire thing. The cause is that we have been overheating the engine of our economy. A lot of economists have been talking about this since the tax cuts, since the extra spending at the governmental level. Just in the last 2 years, we're up $2 trillion in debt above what we were. That's long-term borrowing, except it's not taking place at the long-term area, which is part of the weirdness in the yield curve right now. When we look out at the very short period, we're seeing slightly higher rates than the middle-term period because the government's borrowing at weird areas, trying to make it look like there's not a big debt expense. If they were borrowing at the longer term at these lower interest rates, it would be a lot better long-term decision because long-term interest rates are exceedingly low. If we could get the debt that the government is racking up right now into long-term low interest rate positions, that would be great. That's not what the government's doing. They're borrowing at a much shorter position, which means we have to refinance in just a couple of years.
And for whatever it's worth, a little interesting statistic to drop in the bucket here. During the first 5 months of this year, the U.S. deficit rose 36% when compared with last year, which
right.
is a phenomenal growth, much, much faster growth in the deficit than was anticipated. And it really boils down to the fact that the idea in cutting taxes and increasing spending is that it would increase, this was the theory, that would increase economic activity and generate more taxes that would cover the tax cut. That was a, in my humble opinion, a very poor economic theory, but we called it the great experiment.
Yeah.
And so far, it's not working well at all.
And this is something we spoke about on the air when the tax cut was in its baby stages. We talked about we need a tax cut for the corporate America. We need simplification, which will save a lot of money for your common American citizen. Everyone, all of us, we need simplification. It's too complicated. Then we talked about the Laffer curve. And Laffer is an economist. Arthur Laffer is an economist. We've both met him. Old Baldy here has spoken on the same stage with him a couple of times. And this concept of what is the perfect point, and this, we're talking about a yield curve again, only now it's government revenue curve, the yield on taxes. And that's called the Laffer curve. He was the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors to Ronald Reagan. And he came up with this thing that has driven the Republican Party for several decades. If you're charging taxes that are too high, your revenue is lower than it should be. And I'll give you the simple kind of concept. If you're charging 0% taxes, the government gets zero revenue. That's common sense. If you're charging 100% taxes, the government also gets zero revenue. That's not quite common sense because you, on the surface, you would say 100% taxes, they're getting 100% of everything. They're not, because people won't go to work. They will simply not go to work and pay taxes. They'll be like Greece. They'll go to work and not pay taxes.
Yeah, just tax avoidance becomes a national sport at that point.
Right, because it's completely unrealistic. It's very much like our immigration system. We've got conflicting laws there. But to come back to the taxes, on the tax code, if you're looking at where the taxes lie, somewhere between 0% and 100% is the perfect spot. That's called the Laffer point, because he was really keen on naming this all after himself, which he gets the right to do. It's kind of like the old joke, you know, what the guy that invented the flathead screwdriver said when he saw the Phillips screwdriver? You can name it after yourself. So Arthur Laffer named this curve. And the thing about that point on the curve is it moves around. When the economy is doing really well, you can raise taxes and increase revenue if it's not too high already. When the economy is doing really poorly, you've got to lower taxes. You will maybe lower revenue, but if you raise taxes, you'll lower revenue more because that can cause the entire economy to slow down further. So this concept of lower taxes, increase revenue, we've done it a couple of times. So Bill Clinton did it. First, he raised the capital gains rate when he was in office. That lowered revenue drastically. So he turned around in his second term and signed Newt Gingrich's plan that lowered the capital gains rate, and revenue went up. So then George W. Bush also lowered the capital gains tax rate, and revenue went up. Lowered the overall income tax rate, and revenue went up. Then we had the Great Recession. And in the Great Recession, we did several stimulus deals and put money back in several. One was done by the Bush administration. One was done by the Obama administration. They had differing results. They were lackluster in their results. Governmental stimulus through the tax side of things has a very delayed reaction. It's very slow. However, when you cut taxes drastically, you could tend to see a bigger shift or increase taxes drastically. So where were we on the Laffer point? Well, love or hate it, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is the law of the land, and it got passed. And in the passing of it, it increased taxes on upper-income people, couples making more than $250,000, had a 3% extra tax on their income. It was the 3% surcharge on the wealthy, if you to coin the Democrats' terms. And that's, I think it was misplaced, but revenue went up. So if you raise taxes and revenue goes up,
you're below the Laffer point.
You are below the Laffer point. If you then turn around in the next administration and lower taxes, regardless of politics, just get that out of the way for a minute. It doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican, math is math. Look at it from the mathematical perspective. If we raised taxes and raised revenue, why would immediately turning around and lower taxes also raise revenue? And from a common sense, that's not common sense, but now that you've gotten this far along, everybody that's listened now commonly understands that lowering taxes in that situation should not raise revenue. And it didn't. That's no big surprise here, but we called it the great experiment, because if you could lower it enough, maybe that would force enough innovative activity, new entrepreneurial activity, new businesses growing. But the infrastructure, the highways, and the labor prices have slowed that down, so it's not possible.
Yeah, that's one of the things about trying to grasp economics, which, very frankly, the president doesn't. I'm not trying to denigrate him, neither do the Democrats, for that matter.
Yeah, Nancy Pelosi understands it as well as the president, you know, which is to say neither of them understands
it. Modern monetary theory where we can borrow all the money we want to borrow and it won't have any effect, that is baloney.
We should not call it modern monetary. We should call it modern Greek.
Modern imbecilic theory. But the point is that if you understand economics a little bit, you understand that you can't run an engine faster than it can run. In other words, engines have limitations on how much output they can make. If you give them more gas, they won't necessarily run faster. They may run faster for a short period of time, and then they begin to overheat or they begin to seize up.
Or you throw nitrous in there, and you're going to go faster for a little bit. But you're probably going to break some stuff because it's not designed to run that hot.
When the engine eventually stalls, and it will, when the engine eventually stalls, what happens is forcing it to go too fast makes the stall worse when it comes. And this is the basics of macroeconomics. And it's just a reality. We were coming in on I-35 today, and we were almost late for the radio program, not because it was any accident, but because it was just a jam of traffic on I-35. Why is there a jam of traffic on I-35? Because the economy is running really well, and a lot of people want to go places, and there's a lot of trucks hauling things from one place to another, but we don't have infrastructure sufficient to move that around. I don't know if you've noticed, I've talked to several people who apparently this is a universal thing. The internet is slowing down.
Yeah.
And it's slowing down markedly. I used to be able to go to Google and go on to the Wall Street Journal, and it would always be instantaneous. And I check my local internet connection, and it's good, and everything's fine. It still takes 10 seconds sometimes to get to the Wall Street Journal, not because the Wall Street Journal is not doing a good job or my local internet provider is not doing a good job. It's just that it's reaching capacity.
It's reaching capacity right at the same time period that the federal regulation on that capacity has shifted.
Mm-hmm.
So net neutrality going away has caused the internet to slow down, which was another economic must-happen event. When you allow extra filters in place on internet traffic to say we'll charge these people and not those people, it means you have to be measuring it. And just like with quantum physics, when you're measuring internet traffic, it slows it down. It's not like putting a little rubber strip over a highway that you drive over. That doesn't slow things down. When you're filtering internet traffic to filter some people through a paywall and others not through a paywall, that slows down the traffic.
It is similar to another way of measuring the flow of traffic, though, the way they used to do it, which you put a car out there with a radar in it.
Oh, yeah. And
measure the speeds. And
that slows everybody down.
Everybody slows down because enough of them have radar detectors that they slow down. And the same thing happening in the internet. And it's happening. Well, we've talked about this before. We are out of truck drivers. And at the same time,
you shouldn't say out. We're at full capacity. All of the truck drivers that we have are
driving trucks.
Driving trucks. We have no non-truck driving truck drivers.
And this is there's an irony here when Jake talked about it's a conflagration. I love that term, of economic issues and regulatory issues. Up till this year, actually up to last year, a driver of a truck could keep two sets of logbooks and make it look like he was driving fewer hours than he was driving for the regulation purposes.
Right.
Now
just
they have
pull
to
out one log instead of the other one. Somebody's saying, how much did you drive? Well, here's my logbook.
Now they have satellite-based computers in all the major trucks that you see. They look like little salad bowls turned upside down on top of the truck. And as a result, they have electronic, non-tampering, tamper-proof logs that say, here's how many hours you've been driving. So they wind up, because of regulations, actually having to follow the regulations, which means they're driving fewer hours, and we don't have enough people driving to fill all the needs we have in the economy. So when manufacturers were asked, why are you slowing down? By the way, the manufacturing production did not slow down in the United States last month, but output did. Why did output slow down? Well, because one of the things that caused it to slow down is there's no point in manufacturing something to sell to somebody if you can't get it to them.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And to address the regulation, I think as a whole, everybody listening, anybody that gets on the highway says, yeah, we need to make sure truck drivers have enough sleep. Individually, to a specific truck driver, and we've got, just to make this clear, we've got clients that are truck drivers. We have clients that are not truck drivers, and we're not truck drivers.
We have clients that are not truck drivers?
Yeah, so we have the spectrum covered here.
Okay.
And what that says is that from the truck driver's perspective, there are certainly times that they admit that they are too tired to drive, that they were being kind of forced to drive before, and they're not doing it anymore. But now they feel like they're being forced not to drive more than they should be, that they want to be able to drive. Well, on an individual basis, I might say, hey, that's worth it. It's okay. But as a whole, most truck drivers need more sleep. And this is something important to know. The average age of a truck driver right now is 55 years old.
Yep. And they're starting to hurt.
And they are eating road food, which is not like street food.
It's not
roadkill. They are eating fast food as their normal food, and that if that's all you eat all week, then you shouldn't be surprised when everything hurts, because that leads to inflammation. You have you're overheating your engine again. You've provided a lot more fuel than your body's designed to burn. So you can see this little echo that flows down from the overall macro down to even what's going on in our bodies. When you overfuel, it doesn't make you run extra fast unless your entire body is rigorously trained, has good logistics, if you will, to use that fuel. And our body as an economy doesn't.
Let me throw another factor in here when we talk about the yield curve inverting and the economy growth rate at the very least slowing down, where economists, by the way, somewhere between 1 and 1.3% is what they're saying GDP for this first quarter is likely to be. Now, of course, they could be wrong on that, but I wouldn't be surprised to see them right. In other words, we've dropped from a year ago running at an annualized rate of 4%. Down to an economic growth rate probably this quarter in the 1 to 1.3% range. And what happens next is anybody's guess.
Yeah, we could turn around, and this is what was said in the newsletter this week. We could turn around and see the tariffs go away. What would that do?
Well, if and the president, by the way, just said it isn't going to happen, which may be part of why we just saw things slow down. But if he were to remove the tariffs on, for instance, Canadian steel and steel imported from China, and just completely remove the tariffs he put in and lift the threat of 25% tariffs suddenly dropping out of the sky, I think we get a second wind in the economy. Now, we still are going to hit utilization constraints, but I think it would push the recession into 2021 or thereabouts. We have a caller on 254-773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Thank you for allowing me to speak on your program today. My question is, if a president is ever impeached out of office, how does that affect the economy in the country? You have a good day, sir.
All right.
That's an interesting.
It's not pleasant.
we can say from history that it. Let me simply say, strictly from an economics point of view, the president's erratic behavior compared with what his staff has said, he'll sometimes contradict his staff, has caused a lack of confidence for planning, which hurts the economy.
Yeah, so there's a specific example just today, and that is the Treasury sanctions that were going out against North Korea that had been from the top down
actually
approved,
against Chinese companies.
Yeah, two Chinese companies doing business with North Korea. Sanctions going into place. This was done by John Bolton, who's the national security advisor, the head of the Treasury, Mnuchin, obviously working with the president to do this. It was announced, and then on the same day, a tweet from the president said, nope, we're not doing that. That's very...
From a golf course.
Yeah, from a golf course. That kind of... The administration is supposed to have one voice. It shouldn't. This is the definition of the worst kind of flip flop.
And the reason this is bad is the Treasury Secretary says here's going to be our policy long term going forward. Businesses can plan on it. They can depend on it.
Right.
We can do effective planning and effective investing if we can trust. Now, if the Treasury Secretary, who's supposedly in charge of the United States economy, says something, and after careful coordination and planning and plenty of warning, and then the president overrules him with a tweet.
At the last minute, when the sanction is supposed to, now nobody even knows at the enforcement level. I can give you a guarantee. There aren't very many guarantees that I will give, but this is a guarantee. I guarantee that the president did not sign an executive order on the golf course remanding the sanctions. It was a tweet, which means now that tweet is the official executive order.
And
it's not very clear
when. That means going forward, business leaders cannot trust what the Secretary of the Treasury is saying, which means that their planning, their ability to plan for the future falls off, which means they tend to invest less. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. There's been a lot of talk about U.S. companies doing business with China and that the Chinese require... Well, they call it forced technology transfer. I guess that's the term. Can you guys talk about that? I'm just hopefully, you know, simplistically, hopefully the American CEOs aren't selling out the U.S. technology secrets just to keep the price of their stock up. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Fantastic question.
Good question, and it's one that's been it has been discussed a lot.
Yeah, and we'll approach this from the simplest level. This goes back several decades, but more specifically the last, probably 6 or 7 years. In the last 2 years, it hasn't happened almost at all. What it is a technology company, call it Apple or anybody that wants to build a plant in China for their labor. And there was a lot of that was going on. A lot of new plants were being built in China. And the Chinese government decided that in order to keep some stability in their workforce, they didn't want these people to just be able to uproot and leave without any notice. So basically, the plant itself has to be owned by a Chinese company. So they get to keep something out of this. The investment by the U.S. in making this plant as a Chinese company is held out in that they have a very long contract for the use of that plant. They're the ones putting the money into it. But if they leave, now the plant belongs to the Chinese company, and they can't demolish it. On top of that, in order to make the product that is being made there, the blueprints for that product are important. Now, if it were a completely 100% U.S.-owned plant and it was just Chinese laborers, and there are some of those, some that were able to negotiate through without sharing their secrets, They hold all the blueprints. They own all of the equipment. They own the entire infrastructure of the plant. It's the cases otherwise, those the governmental pressure from the Chinese government to cause American companies to put down roots, to share with the Chinese company, to become partners. That has left patented technology in the hands of the Chinese. Now, I got to say this, right, and then you've got something to say. I'm going to throw this over. The patents are filed publicly. So much of the technology that we use in our equipment, the patents are filed. It's not in-depth and it's not exact, but with the patent and one of the products, you can reverse engineer this stuff, and that's what the Chinese have been doing for decades.
There's another aspect to this, and it is China is not the largest economy in the world, although some people argue that it is. It's not. You have to really twist the numbers. The United States is the largest economy in the world. China is probably number two. But China has more potential buyers and more opportunity for them to buy than any place else in the world. So if you want to do business in China, let's say you want to sell iPhones in China. We talked about that. Even if you don't have even the parts that are non-manufactured in China, one of the negotiations with the Chinese government and with companies in order to offer that phone in China has been typically, we want you to give us some of the secrets that we don't have in how you do your phones in order to have the right to. It's in effect a payment for doing business in China. Now, Japan had a little different point. In many cases, they just simply said, you can't do business here. They never stepped in and said, give us your trade secrets on how you build the phone that you haven't released to us, and then we'll let you sell your phones here. The Chinese are doing that, and they do it with a really good cause. And by the way, we did that. The English have done that, but we did it when we were a developing country and we were trying to catch up with the European countries. And China's basically trying to catch up.
Yeah, there's another piece here that's just happened this week. Angela Merkel, the Prime Minister of Germany, said very clearly that they were going to pursue the Chinese company Huawei doing much of the internet infrastructure work in Germany going forward. That's against the extreme declaration by the German intelligence authorities and the United States intelligence authorities and from the Trump administration, who said, don't do it. Here's the problem when we flip-flop. When the Trump administration says something, nobody knows if it's really helpful advice or just helpful for the U.S. The problem here is that Huawei very clearly, very intentionally, on all of its routers, all of its 5G towers, all of its internet infrastructure, very clearly, this is not hidden, this is very much in the open, funnels back copies of all of that information to China. That means if you're on the phone with a cell phone tower that belongs to Huawei, your information goes back to China. Now, why is that okay from the Prime Minister of Germany to say, hey, we're going to go this way? And I'll tell you why. Because all of the American technology that does the same thing sends copies of that information back to America. Now, that's not a bad thing from our perspective. It's generally not considered to be a bad thing from a German perspective, because the United States has rules in place that says that the NSA is not allowed to look at that stuff without a warrant if U.S. citizens are involved. That last little if U.S. citizens are involved is important. That means that they're allowed to look at it for all German traffic if it's in Germany. And second, this is the more important feature. The NSA does not share corporate information with corporations in the United States that are competitors to a foreign brand. Mm-hmm. The Chinese do.
Yeah, let me give you a little bit of history here. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't fight against this. We should. We should fight against technology transfers, and we should be concerned about data transfers. But A few years ago, Angela, it came out, and I'm not sure how the leak occurred, but it came out that we knew Angela Merkel's secret... Angela Merkel's secret telephone conversations over an encrypted telephone with regard to foreign policy decisions, and they had been fed to the United States government. And so when we were negotiating with her, we knew everything she was talking about on the telephone because we were monitoring her telephone. The reason was...
That was during the Obama administration. Yeah. They were still very offended. Under the Trump administration, they would be far more offended.
The issue is that she had an AT&T phone. And it was an AT&T is an American company. And AT&T was illegal for AT&T to pass information to the... to the United States government on an American citizen, but Angela Merkel is definitely not an American citizen. Therefore, they were basically, AT&T was spying on Angela Merkel. And by the way, she switched to an Ericsson phone after that.
Right.
But the point is that China is doing it on a systematic, large-scale basis, what we were doing on a small-scale basis.
Well, maybe our large scale is much larger in that the NSA essentially is copying all internet traffic right now.
I think they actually stopped that.
The question is whether they stopped it or not. They were doing it.
They definitely were doing it.
The Chinese are not doing that yet, but they might be now. They don't have all of the hubs. They don't have all of the major transfer points for data to do the copying through.
It basically boils down
they're catching up on that point.
It boils down to the fact that Huawei, who denies sharing information with the Chinese government, by the way, to give their story.
Except this is – in denying it, here's how they deny it. We do not directly share with the communist government of China information that we gather. And in saying that, it sounds like they're saying they don't share information with the government. You have to understand Huawei's corporate structure. Every department head has a department head co-head that is a party member that sits there. Sometimes the department head is the party member. So directly sharing is not what's happening. They just share everything. It's just indirect. Sorry, I just needed to add a qualifier.
But I just wanted to say that Huawei is denying it and saying they don't do it. Okay.
Right.
We've not seen any activity, direct activity. The argument is they could do it at any time. And here's the bigger fear. The 5G systems are going in. By the way, the 5G systems are within a few years will be the dominant system in the United States for cell phones and probably internet. The internet itself, your Wi-Fi may go away. In fact, that's the goal of the 5G companies, and this is the issue.
SpaceX is coming out with low satellites, which should add to this mix as well.
Huawei has technology that is several years ahead of anybody else's technology. And by the way, the other two companies that are competing with them are Nokia and Ericsson. There are no U.S. companies that have kept up on 5G with where Huawei is and are big players. We've lost that. We've dropped out of that
system. We lost the initiative.
And Huawei makes these phones, and as far as we know, there is no government subsidies going to them to do this, but because of the size they have and because of the volume they have, they're able to provide this much better equipment much less expensively than anybody else. And so you've got a situation where Huawei may not be doing anything, but the issue of having a Chinese company dominating the communications infrastructure of Western Europe and the United States is a little bit scary because very technically, at least, they could pull the plug on the entire U.S. communications infrastructure anytime they wanted to.
And to say, why is it that the Germans are doing this? And I'll give you a very, very, very simple answer. China has been lowering tariffs over the last several decades against imports from Germany. They have been opening up their doors and saying, bring your stuff in here and we'll buy it. And they've been buying a lot of stuff. We have instituted some huge tariffs across the board. These are negative events, and the focus seems to be on China, but we've instituted huge tariffs on everyone, on Germany, on the UK, on France, on Canada, on Mexico, on Brazil. Everyone has these huge tariffs instituted against them, that does not make them want to do deals with us. It does not want make them want to listen to our advice. We have just been aggressive to them.
One of the reasons, by the way, we had a civil war in the United States, not extremely well-known reason, but one of the reasons is because of technology transfers from the South to the North that enabled, that terrified the Southern, the political cadre in the Southern 13 states by the fact that a lot of manufacturing was going on mainly in the North and the South was being left out of it, and they were very much afraid that these companies from the North who were coming in and making things that were vital to the South could pull the plug on it. And so these things tend to resonate through history, and we have commercials to play.
We'll be back on the other side of the with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. The phone number in here is
254-773-1400.
And we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I wanted to add something. We're almost out of time in the first hour, but I wanted to add something before we leave. Recessions don't just happen suddenly because one indicator says there's going to be a recession.
Right.
And the indicator needs to stay in that position for a period of time, generally a couple of months with the inverted yield curve. But there's another guaranteed this, you don't get recessions without this thing going negative. It's called the Index of Leading Economic Indicators. And it has been alternating between slight negative and neutral, but it has to stay negative for several months before it indicates a recession is coming. And folks, February's Index of Leading Economic Indicators was up 0.2%.
Which is positive. It's a very, very minor positive, but it's there.
But it's still a positive.
That means we are teetering.
And that suggests the LEI, the conference board, says the LEI is predictive 6 months and more out. So the thing that we're not going to have, based on what we know about history, the past is always the past and it's never the future, but still, historically, the leading economic indicators has given us at least 6 months warning on a recession. So it looks more and more like the rest of this year is going to be positive growth. May not have a lot of positive growth, and we think the first quarter is going to be disappointing, to say the least. And we're going to get probably a revision on the fourth quarter that will drop it down to a lower level, probably 2.3 instead of 2.6. And that will bring last year's growth rate below 3%, which is going to make some folks unhappy, but yeah, that's just reality.
Yeah, and when we're measuring these numbers, every effort is made to make sure that they're as correct as they can be, which is why GDP numbers are revised three times. The fourth time is when they're made final. The revision of those numbers is saying, all right, looking at everything that we have to look at, what happened with growth? Did the economy grow or didn't it? That's it's not a basic set of numbers, which is why they have to be revised, because they start with estimates from lots of different sources. And as those estimates firm up and get more realistic, they redo their own general estimate till at the end they say, all right, these aren't going to be revised anymore because this is as close to accurate as we can get. Mm-hmm. And when we're looking at last year, the reality is, whatever number you call it, last year was a good year. If it's 3% or 2.9% growth, that makes, on a personal level, zero difference across any individual in the country. There is no difference between 2.9 and 3% growth. What's important is the overall outlook, and if you start to see that sag, eventually it becomes very important to the individuals.
And one of the things we need to throw a little caveat in there, coming out of the Commerce Department, coming out of the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and even on the even Department of Labor, there's little warnings on all their reports saying we're still missing data from the government shutdown.
And some of the data will never be available.
One of the pieces that we got, I mentioned this earlier, is fourth quarter of last year, services declined to a growth rate that's much lower than was estimated. And we've got to go.
Yep, we got, if you'd like to contact us off the air, you can call us locally, voicemail at
254-947-1111.
You can reach that number toll-free, 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can read our newsletter, read our philosophy, listen to recordings of the radio show going back for quite a few years. And you can contact us through it. You can also email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. We very much enjoy that you were listening. We have a good time doing this program together. Until next hour, this has been The